And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 18th of January. January 18th is National Peking Duck Day, a day invented to encourage people to eat ducks. The white Beijing duck, or Peking duck, is the bird that is traditionally roasted for this meal. The duck is killed at 65 days old, plucked, pumped full of air between the skin and the muscles, soaked in boiling water, and skewered. He or she is then hung to dry, glazed with sugar coating, and left for 24 hours to make their skin crispy. The bird is then roasted. The traditional Chinese Peking duck meal begins with a serving of their skin and a sugar dip. Next, thin pancakes are filled with the duck's tender meat. And finally, duck soup is usually made with the duck's bones, their neck, wing joints, and their feet. But who are these ducks? Ducks are well adapted for water, land, and air activities. These gifted swimmers have waterproof feathers, which have a waxy coating that protects an inner layer of down. A duck's feathers are so waterproof that even when the duck dives underwater, the downy underlayer of feathers right next to the skin will stay completely dry. They can swim in cold water without catching a chill because their feet have blood vessels that are close together so they don't lose heat. Some duck species can dive up to 240 feet below the water, and others can fly as high as 21,000 feet in the air, although most migrate at heights of 200 to 4,000 feet. They can also fly long distances, and they use wind to help them reach speeds of up to 60 miles per hour. Ducks are omnivorous and will eat grass, aquatic plants, insects, seeds, fruit, fish, and crustaceans. Ducklings are lovable siblings and communicate with each other before hatching. Ducklings coordinate hatching by communicating with each other while they're still in their eggs. Hatching at the same time is important because sticking together as a group helps protect them from predators. After hatching, they swim and walk together, following close behind their mothers. Even as adults, ducks are outgoing, social animals who feel most at ease when they're in larger groups of other ducks. In these groups, they are free to spend their days foraging for food and sleeping soundly, knowing their friends will warn them of any danger. Most duck species are monogamous for a breeding season, but they do not often mate for life. Instead, the females will seek out new mates each year, choosing the healthiest, strongest, best mate who can help them pass on their genes to a new duckling generation. Ducks have better vision than humans. The shape of ducks' eyes allows them to see things near and far simultaneously and in sharp focus. And since their eyes are located on either side of their head, they are able to see almost 340 degrees around. They can also move each eye independently and sleep with one eye open to watch for predators. In a group, ducks will trade off keeping an eye open to help protect the rest of the group from danger while they sleep. Ducks have been domesticated as pets and farmed animals for more than 500 years, and all domesticated ducks are descended from either the mallard or the Muscovy duck. Ducks may not come to mind first when you think of animal agriculture, but these intelligent and social birds are the second most commonly slaughtered animals on Earth. Left alone, ducks can live up to 20 years, but they are killed when they are only weeks old when farmed. Ducks are raised and killed by the millions on well-hidden factory farms in order to make expensive delicacies for wealthy diners. To produce foie gras, ducks and geese are force-fed through tubes pushed down their throats until their livers swell to 10 times their natural size. Due to the cruelty of this practice, foie gras is banned in multiple places, including many European countries, the state of California, and New York City. Duck meat brings maximum profits to the industry and maximum suffering to the tortured birds. More than 31 million ducks are killed each year for their flesh. These beautiful animals who are meant to swim, play, forage, and raise their young are deprived of all these natural behaviors when they are crammed by the thousands into dark sheds. Today, celebrate Peking Duck Day by leaving ducks alone. Instead, eat delicious vegan food. And here's a poem for today, The Muscovy Duck by Henry Lawson. It is a wondrous thing to see and a wondrous thing to tell. Her ducklings know as much as ducks the day they leave the shell. That she is proud as proud can be is plain to any dunce. The little ducklings set to work to grow up ducks at once. And on a sunny winter's day, 'tis a good thing for the eyes to see her waddle round and watch her ducklings catching flies. I love her for her waddle and her patience and her pluck, her wag of tail and nod of head, the quaint Muscovy Duck. The Muscovy Duck by Henry Lawson. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with the reminder that all animals want to live. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. We will continue reading from Howard Lyman's book, Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. Today we get to read chapter 4, which is titled From the Farm to the Capital. There's never been a moment in the 33 years of my marriage that I've regretted getting wed. My wife can't say the same, but then I married better than she did. Early on, Willow Jean and I devised a system of shared responsibility. I make the big decisions, and she makes the little decisions. One of the little decisions she gets to make is deciding which are the big decisions and which are the little decisions. An example of a big decision she often assigned to me over the years was what to have for dinner. Now, I've got to admit, I didn't used to appreciate just how profound a decision that was. I've learned the hard way. Willow Jean was a widow with three children when I met her, and I was a content, gainfully employed, fourth-generation Montana farmer, and I knew right off I needed her more than she needed me. But until I met her, I had no idea I needed anyone. Willow Jean doesn't panic easily. One time, around 1968, she was on a flight from Phoenix to Great Falls. She was flying alone, knitting me a sweater. She looked out the window and saw flames coming from an engine. Before long, three of the plane's four engines were on fire. Willow Jean just kept knitting. The woman next to her shouted, "How can you just keep knitting with the plane on fire?" Willow Jean said, "Well, I figure there isn't much I can do about it, and I have to get this sweater finished." I've seen terror in her eyes only once. It was a winter's night in 1979, 11 years into our marriage. We'd added two more children by then to the three we already had, and the farm had grown into an agribusiness of 10,000 acres and 7,000 head of cattle and up to 30 employees. I was lying in a hospital bed facing an emergency operation for a tumor that had been found that same day in my spine. Willow Jean's first husband had died of cancer when he was 28, and the prospect of widowhood once more was a bit much even for her. For my part, I was damn sure I was going to survive, but my surgeon, known around the hospital as Old Cut and Run, had told me not to expect to walk again. I'd had a bad back for 20 years, but I never liked doctors much, so I'd simply decided to live with it. I could never sleep more than 2 hours at a time before the pain would wake me, so I'd just get up and walk around with a book in my hands for a couple more hours till my back could take the strain of bed again. Some folks might go to a doctor for a condition like that, but the thought didn't cross my mind. I got a lot of reading done. Besides, I was smoking 3 packs a day, and that's a hard pace to keep up if you waste too much time sleeping. My condition was more or less stable until I went on vacation with my family, the second vacation we ever took, to the Black Hills of South Dakota. We stayed in a hotel with a pool. That was a real treat for us. And near the pool, we came across something I'd never seen before, a hot tub. After I'd been soaking in it about a minute, I felt a sensation in my back like a grenade exploding. In retrospect, that hot tub may have saved my life, but I haven't stepped into one since, and I don't plan on doing so. By the time I got back to the ranch, still in exquisite pain, I developed another symptom. I couldn't feel my feet hit the ground when I walked. For a moment, I thought this might have meant that I had become a very important person. But then I looked down and saw that I was, in fact, still walking upon the ground. I just couldn't feel it. I kept putting my feet down wrong and spraining my ankles. After this happened enough times, I knew I had to bite the bullet and see a doctor. The doctor hit my knee with a hammer and then looked at me. "How do you do that?" he asked, astonished. "Do what?" I said. "You have no reflex." "Well, I've never been the jumpy sort." "I'm afraid you've either got a tumor or MS. This was exactly why I didn't go to doctors. He sent me to a neurologist who ran me through some simple dexterity tests and ruled out multiple sclerosis. That pretty much ruled in a tumor. I was rushed to a hospital. The snow was coming down hard. The nurses ran a myelogram on me, sent some fluid down my spine. On a monitor, you could see the fluid travel down the spinal cord and then stop when it reached the tumor, which was about the size of my thumb, and I've got big thumbs. The attending physician recommended that I be rushed into surgery. A certain Dr. X was on hand to perform it. Now, I'd known Dr. X a long time, and I'd known his reputation. I wouldn't let the man castrate a goat. I said, "Forget it," and I got on the phone and called my old friend Alex. Alex was a tall, skinny, raw-bone man of about 60, a cattle rancher from Fort Benton and about 50 miles north of Great Falls. He was also the finest surgeon in Montana. He loved ranching, loved roping, loved the land. Nothing about him looked or sounded like a doctor until he took off the gloves he always wore on his ranch. His hands gave him away. One look at his hands, and if you didn't guess surgeon, you'd guess concert pianist. I've never held a man in higher regard. I'd known him long enough to know he never bothered a soul in his life. If you didn't need him, he wasn't around. If you needed him, he was on you like stink. He was that kind of guy. The storm had escalated into a blizzard, and Alex said there was no way he could make it to the hospital that night, but he'd be down at dawn if he had to call in a helicopter. He assured me that I did, in fact, have a major problem. If the tumor was inside the cord, there was less than one chance in a million I'd walk again. But as long as I could move my feet, the operation could wait till morning. If I found I couldn't move my feet, I'd better let Dr. X go ahead and operate. I stayed up all night moving my feet and thinking. I was thinking about what counted and what didn't. Having 10,000 acres didn't count. Having 7,000 head of cattle didn't count. Having 30 trucks and 20 tractors and 7 combines didn't count. Having a $5 million a year agribusiness didn't count. The pleasure of writing million-dollar checks didn't count. My family counted, and the land counted. For some reason, I kept thinking about the soil, the magnetic feel of cool, dark, loamy, worm-laden soil in my hands. I'd grown up with my hands in that soil, and I'd always liked the feeling so much, I rarely troubled to wash them. As a boy, I once went over to the house of a friend whose mother was a stickler for hygiene, and when she gave me the choice of washing the dirt off my hands or not eating supper, it was a no-brainer. I just didn't eat. Suspecting that I would never walk again, yet finding it hard to truly accept this probability, I found myself wondering what kind of invalid I would make. Would I just go around feeling sorry for myself? Or would I be able to move forward with my life? Would I be able to run a 10,000-acre farm from within the confines of a wheelchair? It didn't seem likely. Willow Jean is the most adaptable person I've ever met in my life. She was a town girl who had learned to milk, feed, and brand cows. She was a complete partner. We'd worked together on the ranch full-time during the day and built our house together at night. She was cool and calm and collected even that day, revealing her terror only in her eyes. I could depend on her for virtually anything, but to raise a family of five and run an agribusiness this size with little help from an invalid husband, I couldn't ask that. This was the first night I hadn't slept beside her since we were married. I kept moving my feet, and my thoughts kept returning to how rich the soil had looked when I was a kid. It didn't look like that anymore. Now it crumbled in my hands. It was as thin as sand. There were no more worms in it. After all the tons of herbicides and pesticides and chemical fertilizer I'd poured into it, the soil looked more like asbestos. The trees on and around the farm were dying. The birds were gone. The farm was no longer a living, breathing thing. It was an increasingly precarious chemical equation. I made up my mind then and there that no matter what the outcome of my operation, I dedicate the rest of my life to restoring the land to what it had been when I'd had the good fortune to be born to it. I didn't close my eyes for a moment that night. I thought about how I would know upon waking after the operation if it had been successful. The nurses would surely tell me it had gone well and probably offer some vague bromides of encouragement. But I had a need to learn immediately the truth about whether I would walk again, as if it would require every last moment of my life's energy to defeat the depression that would surely set in if the likely happened. How could I figure out the truth, I wondered, watching my feet swing back and forth. And there I had my answer. My feet would let me know. At the stroke of dawn, I heard a nurse say, "Here comes old Cut and Run," and good as clockwork, Alex strode into the room. He was never known for wasting a word. He didn't say much to me beyond cussing at me for spoiling his weekend, and I was wheeled into surgery. I awoke the next day in the intensive care unit, propped up on my side. The first thing I did was to look down at my feet. I threw off the sheet to expose them. Then, with some effort, I was able to slide down the bed so that they could reach the metal bars at its foot. I felt the metal. It was so cold to the touch. It was the most euphoric sensation I've ever known in my life. A nurse hurried over and tried to move me back up in the bed. I told her there was no way in the world she could get me to move. Alex was in the room by the break of day. He explained that after cutting the bone off the outside of my spinal column, he had discovered that the tumor was not only inside the cord, but also extended beneath it. His only option was to pick a nerve, cut the nerve, and hope the tumor was attached to it like a fish on a line. Alex picked one, cut it, and I escaped paralysis with a one-in-a-million operation. He didn't seem as surprised or moved as I was by that fact. My miracle was simply his day's work. All the same, he was as attentive and concerned as a doctor could possibly be. For 2 days, he made sure I had no residual feeling loss, checked to see that I was getting excellent care from the nursing staff, satisfied himself that I was in good spirits. Then, certain that the operation was an unqualified success and that there was nothing further he could do for me, he up and disappeared without so much as a parting word. Old Cut and Run had lived up to his name. Once I knew I would walk again, I remembered the promise that I had made to myself the night before the operation. I confess I may have winced a bit upon remembering it. Restoring my land to a healthy state was a hell of a project after all the punishment I'd put it through. Still, I had, after all, made that damn vow. I thought about saying, just kidding, but even I had enough integrity not to let myself off the hook that easily. I knew I had a sacred obligation to undo the harm I had done to the land. I just didn't have a clue how to go about it. After a week's stay in the hospital, my friend Joe gave me a ride home. I'll never forget that ride, and I doubt I'll ever understand it. As we drove along, I felt as if the world had accelerated wildly and that we were just cruising at something approaching warp speed. I kept yelling at Joe to slow down. He tried to comply, but eventually he could only laugh at me. We were apparently doing 15 miles an hour, and there I was, still terrified at the velocity. I don't know what that fear was about, whether I was ill or whether my brain was trying to send me some sort of message, but I do know that life slowed down for me considerably during my convalescence at home. Walking was, of course, arduous at first, and the pain resulting from going up and down any kind of steps was excruciating. But it was my eyes that presented me with my worst problem. They had suddenly lost focus. I was seeing double. It was troubling to see two of everything and downright scary whenever my mother-in-law visited. I called Alex and asked him what could be causing the problem. His reaction was memorable. Beats the hell out of me. Wasn't nothing I did. I operate on your back, remember? Eventually, another doctor assured me that the problem was probably caused by a virus and gave me that magical blessing that seems to be the most important lesson of any medical education. It'll go away. There was a strange symbolism to my recent plight that I would have paid good money not to consider. Life was speeding by, and I had lost focus. Unfortunately, there was nothing to do but consider what it might have meant. After all, with my eyes out of focus, I couldn't read, couldn't watch TV, couldn't work. And so I sat and thought and took a long postponed inventory of myself. I didn't much like what I found in the mirror, a couple of cold-blooded twins with a blurry but distinct resemblance to me. I saw in lamentable duplicate a relentlessly calculating individual who did whatever was necessary to achieve his end. Instead of making decisions with Willow Jean, I'd been making them myself, then discussing them with her simply in order to get her to buy into my view of things. I'd fired employees at the drop of a hat. If a worker didn't get the job done fast enough, or showed up late, or failed to observe some specified maintenance procedure with the farm equipment, he was history. I wouldn't think twice about giving him the axe. I had never taken the time to train my employees, never tried to understand their side of any issue. And if I had little compassion for my workers, I had none at all for the animals I prepared for slaughter. They existed for my profit, and my profit alone. I was a no-good SOB, and I couldn't imagine why anyone would think otherwise. I was amazed that a person as good as my wife had married me. I wondered whether she might have simply taken me on as a project. There was an expression, some might say a platitude, I had often voiced in the past. If you're not high on yourself, who else can be? Well, after taking a good look in the mirror, I wasn't very high on myself, and so I had a choice. I could either spend the rest of my life as a selfish, sour person, or I could rectify what I didn't like about myself. I decided to adopt the philosophy, nonsensical as it might sound, that I had a second chance to make a first impression. My priorities changed before my unsteady eyes. Life and health came first. Business and profits lost considerable status. Compassion at last entered the equation as I began to suspect that my disregard for animals as living creatures was somehow related to my disregard for my fellow human beings. I remembered a time when my wife and I were sorting out fattened top-end Charolais cattle for market. I was about to load a 1,400-pound white steer onto the truck when Willow Jean stopped me. She said, "This one's so beautiful. Let's let it go in the next load." I deferred to her reluctantly. In the morning, we found that steer dead. Had it made it onto the truck alive, it would have been worth about $750, and it would have been someone else's problem had it died en route to slaughter. Instead, it was worthless. I had the animal skinned, its hide tanned. I put the tanned hide on the back of our couch. Every time I had looked at that hide before my illness, I could think only about the senseless loss of $750. Now I looked at the same hide and felt, oddly enough, some trace of pity for an animal that I used to regard as an economic unit. It's easy to talk about making a transition from an economic view of animal life to a compassionate view of animals as individuals, living creatures, but it's a hard thing to do when your ability to support your family depends upon efficiently turning those creatures into carcasses. And so I refrained at the time from exploring the possible ramifications of my newfound sympathy toward animals, or from asking myself the big questions about whether raising cattle for slaughter was ultimately a defensible calling. Instead, I focused my mind's eye on the challenge, monumental enough, of pursuing that calling with a renewed respect for the land. In common with most ranchers who grew crops for their herds, weeds caused me far more problems than insects or weather or anything else. And at that time, I must have been spraying 100 times more herbicide than insecticide. The worst offender was a devil of a weed called leafy spurge. It emits a natural toxin which kills surrounding crops that compete with it for water and nutrients. If I was truly going to revamp my farming methods to protect the land, my priority had to be attacking the weed problem in a new way. I was not alone in my losing battle against weeds. When I announced the formation of a local weed control group to look for alternatives to the chemical war on weeds, the response was tremendous. 150 farmers showed up in the middle of a blizzard to take part in a discussion of new approaches to weed management. We talked about methods of biological and mechanical weed control and integrated pest management. Since a weed is nothing more than a plant out of place, we discussed the possibility of tracing a plant to its origins and researching the natural control agents that keep the plant from proliferating in its native environment. We didn't know all the answers, but at least we each knew we weren't alone in our frustration with chemical techniques. Meanwhile, I talked with a bank officer about getting a loan that would enable me to make the transition to the kind of farming that would restore the land. I would need capital to rebuild the soil with compost, rock dust, and green manure, a crop such as clover grown and plowed back down in order to fix nitrogen from the air and put it into the soil. The banker asked me why I wanted to do this. I told him that I was attempting to practice something very old, farming in association with nature. "What the hell does that mean?" he asked. "I want to become an organic farmer," I said. He looked at me with astonishment. "And you want my help?" "Yes." "It won't happen, Lyman," he said. "Turning the clock back to this organic business will never work, and I've got other customers who wouldn't care for it." He meant the chemical dealer, the pharmaceutical dealer, the fertilizer dealer, all of whom I was effectively cutting out of the action. "We have a system here that functions just fine, and you're asking to mess with it." I started then to glimpse the interconnectedness of banking, factory farming, and the giant chemical and pharmaceutical firms. We farmers were caught in a kind of corporate straitjacket. I felt like I had just gotten myself thrown out of a big fraternity, and for the first time it occurred to me that ultimately I had to get out of farming. I knew I had a big fight on my hands, and my farm with its spiraling debts wasn't the most strategic ground from which to wage it. It was around this time that my eyes regained their focus. I put them to some of the best work they have ever done. I read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Published in 1962, it remains a timeless wake-up call to the nation. From the point of view of the chemical industry, the book must be like one of those annoying car alarms that just won't shut off. It should be required reading for every high school student in America, not to mention every farmer. I wish I had read the book before I began my career in farming, instead of picking it up only after I had decided to get out. When Carson wrote so movingly of the dangers of pesticides to our rivers and to wildlife and to human health, 637,666,000 pounds of the synthetic poisons were being produced a year. Today, as Vice President Gore points out, production of these toxins has increased by 400%, and the harm they do is cumulative. In Carson's words, this pollution is for the most part irrecoverable. The chain of evil it initiates not only in the world that must support life, but in living tissues is for the most part irreversible. Along with the other members of my weed control group, I began to lobby the state legislature to fund a new small facility at Montana State University to conduct research into biological pest and weed control. You would think that this would be a harmless political cause, but the chemical industry fought us every step of the way. They played hardball, threatening the funding of various departments throughout the university system if this little research facility was created. The university consequently became wary of getting too closely involved with those of us who were pushing biological approaches to agricultural problems. The chemical industry certainly acted as if it was scared of something. Luckily, the chairman of the relevant legislative committee was from Corvallis, the town where the satellite facility would be built, and he was happy to bring home the pork. Eventually, our weed control group hired a graduate student in agriculture to help develop a biologically sound way to control leafy spurge. We found that Romania was the weed's country of origin, and since leafy spurge was not a problem there, we deduced that a natural control agent must exist. We sent our student to Romania, and he came back triumphantly with a collection of beetles and other insects that would eventually help us combat the problem. On my own farm, I implemented integrated pest management practices, and at the sign of a pest like weevils, chose to harvest my crops early rather than spray. I had never had a political bone in my body. I wouldn't have been able to tell you at the time if I was a Democrat or a Republican, and I'm not sure that I ever bothered reading a flyer, much less delivering one. But my involvement in the seemingly nonpartisan cause of battling weeds non-toxically was giving me, willy-nilly, a political education. When the Montana Agricultural Extension Service, a program of the Department of Agriculture, asked me to co-chair its effort to increase its state funding, I agreed to lobby the legislature for the group with the condition that its priorities be reorganized. They agreed, and the results of our efforts were not only an increase in the funding of the state's extension service, but an allocation of millions of dollars into research on biological weed control. Today, Montana may well lead the nation in biological weed control. I got another political lesson when a friend called and asked me to take a look at the deaf and blind school in Great Falls. I had passed it many times, but had never poked my head inside. When I did so at my friend's request, I saw that it was in abysmal condition, the whole building rotting, the children passing their days in unsafe and unsanitary conditions. I told my friend that I would do what I could to help get a new school built, thinking I had a chit to call in with the governor, whom I knew well, but he offered only sympathy, claiming that his fiscal hands were tied. I learned then that relationships weren't nearly as important in the world of politics as leverage. I decided to take my request to the state senator, who was chairman of the Long Range Building Committee, which controlled funds that the governor relied upon for his own pet projects. With a state senator's support, I got $7 million allocated for a new deaf and blind school, and I'm proud to say it stands today in Great Falls, Montana, a monument to pure political leverage. One day, I was griping to Willow Jean about politicians, and she uttered a sentence she came to regret mightily. If you're not going to do something about it, then you have no right to complain. So I ran for Congress. Since it turned out that I was a registered Democrat, I entered the 1982 Democratic primary for Montana's Eastern Congressional District. Now Montana has only one district. And to my surprise, I won. As I told my equally astonished wife on our victorious primary night, if I won the general election as well, we'd finally be off the farm, as Willow Jean dearly wanted. On the other hand, the prospect of being a congressman's wife with all its attendant limelight was not exactly her idea of fun. Anticipating a move to Washington, I began to wind down the feedlot, drastically reducing my number of head of cattle. I needed to minimize the managerial requirements of running a farm at the same time I was running a campaign. My general election campaign was based on three basic themes: clean air, clean water, and clean food. We developed a coalition based not on political ideology, but on concern for the land we farmed, the air we breathed, and the water we drank. Montana's voters may not have been ready to support a campaign centered on organic farming, but they did and do have an abiding concern for the environment. And they understood intuitively when I made the point that family farming could restore the land that factory farming was destroying. I caught people's attention as a candidate who was a factory farmer taking the side of the family farmers. I wasn't pointing a finger at someone else. I was pointing at myself. I had met the enemy, and it was me. I believed then, and I believe now, that family farms ought to be considered our greatest natural resource, and that the fundamental healthfulness of our food and the long-term health of our economy are closely tied to their well-being. I called for programs targeted to help family farms and all farms that withdrew from polluting practices. With the momentum gained by having won an upset victory in the Democratic primary, my campaign caught fire, and I like to think it scared the hell out of the petrochemical industry. Republican and independent voters were coming my way, as often as Democrats. The campaign had nothing to do with party affiliation. It had everything to do with the basic value of respect for the land. And then, as the polls showed me pulling ahead with 6 weeks to go in the race, my bank suddenly foreclosed on my farm. This development caught me by surprise, although I suspect my opponent may have been more prepared for it. Typically, my bank would simply roll over the debt of any farmer like myself who had more than ample value in the land as collateral. But for some reason, in the heat of the campaign, the bank saw fit to foreclose. The headlines made people wonder, if this guy can't run his own farm, should we send him to Washington to represent us? I dropped precipitously in the polls when the story came out, then started coming back, but I didn't have enough time to regain all the ground and wound up losing 52% to 48%. A year later, in order to settle all my debts, I sold the farm to a Hutterite colony, leaving myself with only my great-grandfather's homestead, which had been its nucleus. In 1987, I was invited to work as a lobbyist for the National Farmers Union in Washington, D.C., and Willow Jean and I moved to the nation's capital. I didn't get there as a politician, but as someone paid to twist politicians' arms. Initially, I felt like a country bumpkin surrounded by bright, slick, highly qualified bureaucrats, lawyers, lobbyists, and congressional staffers. I was probably an entertaining spectacle for them, looking as if I fell off a turnip truck. I was perhaps the sole lobbyist in the district with only one suit. I was also probably the only lobbyist in town who believed in the American Civics book view of government, that voters elect representatives to speak for them in office, and that the interests of his or her constituency are an office holder's paramount concern. Slowly but surely, though, I learned to play the beltway game. While much that I gleaned would make a person cynical, there was one heartening lesson at the center of it all. The key to having any degree of success in Washington is, believe it or not, hard work and honesty. Your currency on the Hill is your word. As soon as your word is devalued, you are lost. I made sure not to make any promises I couldn't keep. I never even promised Willow Jean I'd get a second suit. I just said I was open to considering it. I considered it long and hard and bought another sport coat. While working for the National Farmers Union, I naturally lobbied to maintain or increase many farm subsidies. At the time, I believed that this was the best way to help small farmers. I agitated for subsidies that were structured in such a way as to help family farmers more than factory farmers. Certainly, our system of subsidizing farmers seemed complex, bureaucratic, and expensive, but it was the only system we had, and my job was to make it work better for my constituency, family farmers. Another issue I went to work on was the National Organic Production Act of 1990. The purpose of this piece of legislation was to create a uniform, enforceable system of standards by which food could be labeled organic, so that when a consumer saw that label, he or she could know what it meant and trust that it was representing itself honestly. The multinational ConAgra wanted to label beef organic if the entity that owned factory-raised cattle for only, say, the last 6 weeks of its life didn't further adulterate it with hormones and other chemical products. That wasn't my idea of organic, and I don't think it was the consumer's idea. Organic foods were then and remain now the fastest growing segment of the food market. And the bill was designed to regulate this exploding industry and prevent unjustifiable claims from undermining it. The only problem was that the bill was considered by Capitol Hill insiders to be destined for defeat. Petrochemical interests were lined up against it. And the first rule for most members of Congress is, when in doubt, vote no. I knew that if those of us behind the bill worked diligently to crank up support from our troops, the organic farmers, the health food businesses, maybe some health activists and consumer groups, the end result would simply be a countervailing increase in the lobbying and pressure tactics of the petrochemical industry. So I chose instead to let the bill look as if it was going to die a quick and painless death. Meanwhile, shortly before the vote was scheduled, I went to my friends in organized labor, with whom farm groups had formed a coalition that met regularly on the Hill. Organic standards was not an issue high on the list of big labor's concerns, but they had nothing against it. They went to bat for us on the day of the vote. Labor's representatives were at the door of the House chamber giving the members a thumbs up on the bill. We needed the urban constituency, and now we had it. Members hadn't heard enough from the other side to feel that it was a risky vote. We caught our opponents asleep at the switch, and the result was the passage of the Organic Production Act of 1990. The White House, which had opposed the measure, went nuts with frustration since the bill was tied to an appropriations bill that President Bush wanted and needed to sign. And so he reluctantly signed the Organic Production Act into law on November 28, 1990. It was a heady victory, and I still believe that ultimately it can and will serve some good purpose. But I'd be disingenuous if I didn't also acknowledge that as of this writing, the National Organic Standards have yet to be codified by the Department of Agriculture and put into effect. Such are the frustrations of trying to bring about change in Washington, D.C. It's definitely not impossible, and it's always worth trying. But more and more, I've come to feel that most fundamental changes in this country come from the grassroots, from the bottom up, and the game Washington plays best is catch up. One summer day in Washington in 1990, during the low-key campaign for the Organic Production Act, I was sitting with my feet up on my desk, looking out at the Potomac. The humidity was 98% and it was hot enough to make a mosquito sweat. I started thinking about all the issues, personal and political, that were concerning me. I was feeling a growing sense of cynicism about my work and about the chances to affect change through legislation. I lived through the relentless decline of the family farm. I knew that most of the bureaucratic subsidies I was fighting for went to the raising of feed crops, not human food. I'd read a whole host of depressing statistics about the loss of rainforest through the world, and I knew that the lion's share of that rainforest loss came about in order to clear land for cattle grazing. I'd read, too, that livestock outnumbered humans on the planet by 5 to 1. I learned that about 50% of our water usage in this country is dedicated to the production of meat, and that our natural aquifers are being depleted at an alarming rate. I learned that we were losing topsoil at a rate of 1 inch every 16 years, and that much of that loss of topsoil was related to cattle grazing and to the chemically intensive methods that factory farmers were using and that I had once used. I'd seen rivers polluted from the waste of cattle and pigs and chickens, and seen birds disappear from the skies over fields sprayed with herbicides that were meant to facilitate the growth of crops used to feed those animals. I'd put many thousands of head of cattle into confinement and seen how they suffered from unnatural conditions. I knew that while 1 billion people went to sleep hungry, the overfed part of the world was busy feeding 16 pounds of grain to cattle in order to make 1 pound of beef. I'd seen countless friends suffer from heart attacks or require heart surgery. I'd seen the cancer rate in America increase dramatically. My own health was hardly exemplary. I weighed 350 pounds. My cholesterol was over 300. My blood pressure was off the charts, and I was getting nosebleeds. And suddenly, the circle came together for me. We were, as a civilization, making one big mistake. A mistake that was understandable because we had been raised to make it. We had been culturally indoctrinated to believe it to be not a mistake at all, but rather a normal and healthy habit. But this mistake was killing us as individuals, just as it was destroying our land and our forests and our rivers. We were eating dead animals, and it wasn't working. If those animals had set out to take their revenge on us, they couldn't have done a better job. And I became, right then and there, something I never dreamed I'd become: a vegetarian. At first, I had trouble announcing the fact to others because I honestly wasn't acquainted with any admitted vegetarians, and I feared ridicule. I knew many members of Congress who were gay, some of them openly so, but I didn't know any who were vegetarian. I did know one aging hippie woman from Montana who was vegetarian, but her name was Atlantis. Most folks back home in Montana would rather be caught riding someone else's horse than be accused of vegetarianism. I'd always been more or less a macho kind of guy, and vegetarian just wasn't how I saw myself. Within a year of eating no meat, my health problems all started to go away. Not only did I feel better physically, but I felt better knowing that there was one answer to many of the different ills afflicting both ourselves and our environment. Everything revolved around the fork. And that was chapter 4 of Howard Lyman's book, Mad Cowboy: Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. And we'll read chapter 5 next time. And we'll finish today's shows by reading a couple of articles from Veg News. The first one is titled, "New York Has a New Mayor, and He Wants to Free Central Park's Horses." Zohran Mamdani reaffirms his intention to ban horse-drawn carriages and has found an ally in a trans mega pop star. Horses have been part of the fabric of New York City for centuries. First brought to the city by European colonial settlers, they were once essential for everything from transportation to delivery services to firefighting. Today, cars and trucks perform all of these functions, but horses still walk the streets of New York, now largely pulling carriages full of tourists in and around Central Park. Many people believe it's time for that tradition to end. New Mayor Zohran Mamdani is among them. Even before he was elected in November 2025, Mamdani expressed support for a ban on horse-drawn carriages in the city. Just before officially taking office in December, he doubled down on that position. "I support removing horse carriages from Central Park," he said. "I intend to deliver on that." German singer-songwriter Kim Petras is also on board with Mamdani's mission and has even promised to privately send the new mayor a copy of her new album if he manages to get horse carriages banned from Central Park. While the offer may seem unusual, it has context. It followed Mamdani's revelation to Interview magazine in December that he's a fan of Petras' music. He also likes Madonna and Lil Wayne, for the record. Mamdani and Petras are far from alone. Activists, celebrities including Billie Eilish, Joaquin Phoenix, and Bella Hadid, and politicians have been pushing to ban horse-drawn carriages in New York City for years. The ongoing campaign to ban horse-drawn carriages in New York City. In 2024, Councilmember Robert Holden from District 30 introduced Rider's Law. The proposed legislation, named after Rider, a horse who collapsed in Manhattan in 2022, aimed to ban horse-drawn carriages in Central Park by June 2026. Ultimately, the bill stalled and failed in committee in November 2025. Still, Mamdani's pledge has renewed hope among advocates that a ban could finally be within reach. "We absolutely expect Mayor-elect Mamdani to keep his promise," Adita Brinkrant, executive director of New Yorkers for Clean, Livable, and Safe Streets, told CBS News. NY Class is an animal rights nonprofit dedicated to ending the use of horse-drawn carriages in New York City. The organization argues that the industry is outdated, dangerous, and inhumane, alleging that horses are overworked, denied adequate veterinary care, and confined to small unsanitary stalls when they are not working. In 2019, NY Class successfully backed the Carriage Horse Heat Relief Bill, which effectively prohibits drivers from forcing carriage horses to work in high summer temperatures. While Rider's Law failed to advance, the movement has made incremental progress in recent months. Before leaving office, former Mayor Eric Adams issued an executive order requiring all carriage horses to be inspected by a city-approved veterinarian. Now NY Class is campaigning for a hearing on Rider's Law, with a newly elected mayor publicly committed to ending the practice. Advocates believe New York City may finally be on the verge of leaving carriage horses in the past. And let's also read the article, "Why Olivia Colman and Stranger Things star Matthew Modine Want You to Go Vegan." Matthew Modine and Olivia Colman are supporting Veganuary 2026, encouraging people to cut back on animal products for the planet. Veganuary is back for its 12th year, and once again, the campaign, which encourages people to ditch animal products for the month of January, has enlisted a host of celebrities to help spread the message. For 2026, actors Matthew Modine and Elaine Hendricks are joining the campaign alongside content creator Priyansh Parekh, better known online as the Tofu King, writer, broadcaster, and disability advocate Samantha Ranke, British soap actor Victoria Ikenoye, and novelist Jane Fallon. Speaking about his decision to join Veganuary for 2026, Modine, who stars as Dr. Brenner in the hit Netflix series Stranger Things, highlighted the urgency of reducing animal consumption for the sake of the planet. "We humans have evolved into super consumers of everything the earth we share has to offer. In doing so, we've simultaneously evolved into something like the equivalent of a life-destroying comet, Modine said in a statement to Veganuary. Cutting back on the consumption of animal flesh is a very tiny step each of us can take to make the planet more sustainable and humane, he continued. Take a moment to learn more about proactive steps you can take by following Veganuary. His comments echo previous statements issued by Veganuary ambassadors like Joaquin Phoenix, Billie Eilish, and Paul McCartney. By replacing meat consumption with plant-based foods, together we can give the earth a fighting chance, Eilish has previously said. Actor Olivia Colman is also supporting the Veganuary 2026 campaign by contributing her own Tadka Dal recipe to the Veganuary 2026 Celebrity e-cookbook. Hendrix has also shared a recipe for sugar-free chocolate mousse. Veganuary expands again for 2026. This year, Veganuary is hoping to build on the momentum of recent years. In 2025, the organization reported that 25 million people worldwide took part, up from 700,000 signups in 2023. The jump reflects a new method of estimating participation. Last year, the campaign commissioned nationally representative surveys across 11 core countries. The updated figure is based on those results combined with population data from each country. For 2026, Veganuary has expanded further into Iceland and Ireland and made its pledge available in a new language, Hindi. Most people already love animals, care about their health, and are thinking about how to live more lightly on the planet, said CEO Wendy Matthews. This January, we're here to help you make small shifts that reflect what you already care about most. It's less about changing and more about returning to who you already are. It's not too late to get involved. Participants can still sign up to take the Veganuary pledge and access free resources, including meal plans and the Celebrity Cookbook. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.